There was a process of painting that my grandmother invented herself back about 1950. It was called the earth pigments. A lot of people mistake them for sand paintings. See, there's a photograph of my grandmother up here on the wall, and she's grinding earth. She would go out and she would collect rocks out in the desert, like the Painted Desert, and bring them back. She always traveled with her coffee cans, you know, so she was always picking up dirt, different colors of earth. And these are all natural colors. So she would put them on her mono and metati and grind them. And it's really hard work. I tried grinding corn, and that's hard work. But rocks are especially difficult. And so she would have jars of ground earth, which was, you know, eventually she got really good at it, and it had the consistency of, like, baby powder. And she would mix that with Elmer's glue and water for the binder. Wow. Yeah, which is really cool. And so she would paint layers and layers and layers of paint. So there's about seven separate layers of paint on each one of these paintings.
What made her want to do that rather than using pastels or whatever other?
Well, she actually learned when she was a student with Dorothy Dunn at the Indian School back in 1932. She actually learned how to paint with casein watercolors. And caseins are sometimes mistaken for gouache, but caseins are a milk base and they're very opaque. This piece over here is a good example of the product that came out of the Indian School by my grandmother. My grandmother went in painting things very flat. She actually learned that flat style not from Dorothy Dunn, which everybody wants to credit Dorothy Dunn with, but actually Tonita Pena. Tonita Pena was one of the San Ildefonso self-taught five. One of the other artists in that group was Julian Martinez. He was married to Maria Martinez. So they painted flat. The only difference is that there was not a lot of detail in their paintings. Dorothy Dunn came in and she taught my grandmother about detail, you know, what's going on in the scene. You know, Vel soap. Do you remember Vel soap? You know, there's a Coke bottle, you know, very detailed. What is the accurate way to portray what people are doing in day-to-day Pueblo life? And my grandmother had really a photographic memory. You know, she could think of a scene, a typical Santa Clara Day scene, and paint it, you know, and she would sketch it out first. Maybe sometimes she would use tracing paper, or maybe sometimes she would just do, you know, sketch right on her board, and then she would paint it. Well, her paintings evolved after years, you know. Now then she started incorporating backgrounds. You know, this painting here is straight on white background, which is very typical of the Santa Fe Indian School studio composition. But my grandmother started portraying things in the background, maybe sort of a cloud scene, you know, or, you know, this is in 1987. This is more involved with the spray technique, you know, and the kasharis and with the dancer and the kasiki. So she took something that she learned at a very early age, which was probably no much better than high school art, and she just ran with it and evolved it, you know. And a lot of the other artists that were in that studio class with Dorothy Dunn, they either took whatever Dorothy Dunn taught them and flourished and kept going further in their art education. For example, Alan Hauser. That first class was a class of titans. You had my grandmother, Poblita Velarde, Alan Hauser, Carl Gorman, who is R.C. Gorman's father, mm-hmm. Narciso Abeda, who is Tony Abeda's father, Oscar Howe, Harrison Begay. These were the artists that started that whole first era.
And was she the only woman?
She was the only full-time female student of Dorothy Dunn's, yes. And then once she graduated from the Indian School, she was hired by the WPA. And for a short while, she traveled with Ernest Thompson Seton and was his nanny for his daughter, Beulah. And so she traveled around the country with them for a few months, and they would take her to see museums and galleries and things, you know. And then she got the job with the WPA to start painting depictions of Pueblo life for Bandelier National Monument.
And when did, when she started, you were starting to talk about when she started working in the earth.
Okay, let me get back, let me come back to that. When she was working, let me point out that when she was working for the WPA at Bandelier, she was making $5 a day. That was the same wage that Jackson Pollock and William de Kooning were making, working for the WPA as well. And the And so it was a pretty phenomenal thing, you know. She was making more money than the men were making working for the CCC, blowing up the roads, you know, to make roads, and they were breaking their backs and, you know, chopping down trees and, you know, really risking their health. And here she was painting, you know. And she saved her money and moved to the built a house for herself at Santa Clara, and then she brought in electricity for that house because the Pueblo had no electricity. And then about 1960, she brought in the telephone, which was really funny. She was a real pioneer with stuff like that. She loved modernization. So the earth pigments, going back to the earth pigments, what happened was that she felt that she wanted to depict more of the cave-dwelling element, which you can see over here in this painting. Some of the cave dwellings, some of the pictographs and petroglyphs on the rocks, you know, and the best way that she could do that, her inspiration came from those natural drawings, you know, the ancient drawings, but this was the best way that she could figure out how to portray that earthy feeling.
Wow.
Look at how smooth the paint is, you know. And even this particular painting that we're looking at called Petroglyph, which she did about 1960, this is much more refined than even something that she did maybe back around 1950. See how rough it is?
Yeah.
These are two deer. They're actually sort of almost Deco style. And if you know your art history, the Deco style was very popular in the 40s and 50s. And so, you know, you have very, very grainy earth pigments. She hadn't at this point learned to refine her medium yet. And you have very thick lines. You know, there's not a lot of detail as you would see in something, you know, that she painted in maybe 1972.
Mm-hmm. So I think you were starting to talk about when she started doing the murals. And I interrupted you.
The first murals I think that she probably worked on were the ones at Maisel's in downtown Albuquerque.
Oh.
Okay, and that was a part of a WPA project as well. I think she worked on, the next mural might have been for Foote's Cafeteria in Houston, Texas. And that was a very large mural. I believe it was 24 feet in length or 21 feet in length by 6 feet. And that now belongs to the Autry Museum in California.
Did she do it by herself? Only by herself?
She did do it only by herself. She didn't like working with other people. She didn't have a lot of patience for trying to tell somebody how to do something. Mm-hmm. You know, she'd rather do it herself. She was a petite woman. She was about, probably 5'1", maybe 5'2". You know, if she stood up straight. But she, you know, she was very strong. She worked on these panels. There were, I think 7 panels in all. So I think it was probably a 21-foot long mural. So the mural that now belongs to the Autry belonged to Foote's Cafeteria, and it was purchased by the Autry a few years ago. It is now in a traveling museum show and was recently here at the Museum of New Mexico.
Yeah.
So,
and show me that you were talking about the painting that she did, the last one she did before the year before she died, that you have here?
The year before she died, hold on a second. This is dated 2002, but she actually went back and painted on it some more in 2005. So she said, no, I'm just going to leave the year. I already painted it on there. Who cares? but no, and I actually own the painting that she was working on when she did die, which is a scene of San Geronimo Day at Taos, the Taos pole climb. So
she was working on a painting when she died, just as your mother was.
Yeah, she worked on this Taos pole climb until about a week and a half before she died. She died of pneumonia. And she just, you know, the flu was really bad that year in 2005, 2006. And when we took her into the emergency room, there was no place for her to sit down. Everybody was in there with respiratory stuff, you know. Even though this painting was 2002, she did finish it in 2005. She went back and she changed some stuff. It's a really good example of how closely she paid attention to detail. She always claimed that she was, you know, going blind, and she actually did go blind for a very small period of time as a toddler. She and her sister did. They got an eye infection, and their grandmother, who is a medicine woman, used a bunch of herbs to cure the infection, but then it scarred their vision, so it took a long time for it, you know, to get back to semi-normal, I guess. But this is the detail of a woman who's going blind, you know. I mean, this is just fanatic detail. It was funny. For a while, she stopped painting because she was having real trouble with her eyes. And we took her in to get cornea transplants, and she could see again. And so she was doing really, really good, you know. And then she stopped painting again. She said, I just can't get my eyes to work. I guess I'm just going to have to quit, you know. I just don't know what else to do. And so anyway, we got her an HD TV. And all of a sudden, she could see again. Well, the vision, the screen, the tube in her TV was what was going out, not her eyes, you know. So,
and for people who have just tuned in, we're talking about Pablita Velarde, and you had said that it was Dorothea Dunn who had talked to her about bringing in the detail.
Yes, Dorothea Dunn. She really made my grandmother and her other students pay close attention to what the ceremonial outfits were. You know, she wanted to teach them that their art could really come to life, and it didn't have to be flat if they didn't want it to be, you know, that things mattered, like the coral on a necklace or the evergreens. Evergreens weren't just green sticks. They had needles, and things had texture. And then my grandmother, that instruction stopped after a couple of years at the Indian school. And then my grandmother just relied on her own need to develop her imagery further, and she just continued to do so. You know, it was something that she desired. It was her passion, and she just kept working on it. You know, she was also the first Pueblo woman published. She published a book in 1960 called Old Father Storyteller. And she wrote all of the stories that she had grown up with as a little girl. She got her father to help her remember the stories properly. She wrote them, and then she illustrated the book. And then it was published by Northern Publishers in Arizona.
Do you know what made her, why she was picked along with those other artists who were so important to be part of that first class, how she got involved in it?
They just happened to be there, really, just going to the Indian school, and they wanted, you know, some of them leaned more toward doing art. Although the art form in, back in those days, you know, producing art was really a men's job. You know, it was, you know, the men who painted in the kivas, it was the men who painted the sand paintings. It was, you know, it was a man's thing to do. And for a woman to paint a painting and much less sell it was completely unheard of. And while she was at the Indian school, she got so much flack. I mean, she was being slapped on her rump, and she was being, you know, pushed around and criticized, you know, go in the kitchen, go do woman's work, you know. You shouldn't be painting. This is a man's job, you know. And my grandmother pretty much, that's where she learned how to tell them all where to go, you know. She did not put up with anything. And her mentor, Tonita Pena, told her, don't put up with it. You have every right to paint just as much as they do.
Good.
And so she got a lot of support from Tony DePena and from Dorothy Dunn, you know, just to continue to do that. And
when she was doing the murals, that must have been even more revolutionary.
It was revolutionary, you know. I mean, Poblita Velarde was the first full-time female painter, native female painter, to paint full-time as a career, period. Period. You know, she did it for a career. She made a living at it. She painted the murals because she was commissioned to do so. And she did a beautiful job. There's a mural that was up here at the First National Bank of Santa Fe. Nobody knew anything about it. You know, it was done, I believe it was commissioned in 1964, maybe, for the branch up at Los Alamos Labs. And then it was moved down here to Santa Fe. And they just had it stuck in a hall. You know, nobody knew the significance of it. Yeah. Nobody had a value on it, you know. And then all of a sudden it was like, holy smokes, what do we have, you know. And so they came over and they got us and said, you know, can you come over and take a look at your grandmother's mural? And so we did, and it was phenomenal, you know. It was just, her scenes and her figures are like looking at her. The facial structures are very much Poblita Velarde. You cannot look at a Poblita Velarde painting and not know that it's a Poblita Velarde. You know, her style is unmistakable.
Mm-hmm. When she was painting the murals at the All-Indian Pueblo Cultural Center, there's different murals from different... She probably was the only woman there, too.
My mother was the other woman there. The mural that my grandmother painted, which is on the west-facing wall on the left in the courtyard of the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center. My grandmother and Jose Rey Toledo were the first ones to start painting on their murals. And my grandmother made them build her a 3-foot platform because she was short. And so she painted a herd dance, and it was life size. And in the herd dance, the female behind the lead buffalo dancer is a self-portrait. And you can look at it and you can see her. The hair is just the same. The face looks just the same. And that was really a difficult project for her because she did it in the middle of summer. And you know, summer in Albuquerque is not a pleasant thing. And she would get there at 8 o'clock in the morning and she would paint until the sun would come just over the building about 1 o'clock. And then she would stop for the day because it would just get too hot. And so it took her probably the better part of 3 months to paint that mural. And then she had to get ready for Santa Fe Indian Market on top of it because she did the Santa Fe Indian Market every year without fail. So it was painting the mural in the morning and then going home and painting paintings for Indian Market. My grandmother would do on a regular basis during the peak of her career probably 5 or 6 shows a year. My grandmother would do road trips. She would just pack up her station wagon with a load of paintings and an ice chest and blankets and hit the road and go pedaling, you know. And it's really funny, you know, because, you know, here's this incredible woman, you know, and she's still out there pedaling, you know. but she just, you know, she wasn't too good to do certain things, you know. If she needed money to buy a new car or to put a down payment on a house or something, she would find a way to do it. She was not too good to do anything. She would appear in Senate hearings, you know, and then she would come home and she would bake for bake sales or, you know, clean her bathroom or whatever. She was a very real person from very humble beginnings.
Let's walk through the rest of the... Oh, I love those pictures. Oh, there's your mother, too.
That was my mother. This was a photograph of my mother that was taken about 1973. My mother was... Everybody calls her, you know... She was a really hot rock and roll chick, you know. But she wasn't really into rock and roll. It was pretty funny. She really appeared when it was the right time. The time when things were changing in the 60s and late 60s and early 70s when women were starting to fight for their own independence and really fight for being able to express themselves creatively. My mother was written up in an article a couple of years ago and compared to Gloria, Joan, and Jane. And that was what was real, was that she was the happening chick. You know, when R.C. Gorman, Allen Houser, Michael Cabote, Tony Day, Fritz Scholder, and Charles Loloma were all the male contemporaries that were out to change Indian art from traditional, which is what you saw with my grandmother's era, to what we see now as contemporary Indian art. You know, and my mom was the lone chick, you know, and she painted circles around those guys, you know, and she was the one that everybody just fell in love with. I mean, she had pizzazz, charisma, she was intelligent, she knew what was important, you know, to express, she was articulate, but she also had her own beginning of tragedies, you know, that she overcame.
Meaning?
She was when I was a baby, we were in a situation with my real father, and he was very abusive, and we had to leave the country and go live with my grandfather in Bogota, Colombia. That also happened to be one of my mother's very first shows at the U.S. Embassy, and she sold out her paintings. And so anyway, we moved there to get away from my real father. And then when we came back, my mother didn't go back to him. Instead, she had enough money to buy a small car, and we rented our own house, and she was very independent. She took care of herself, and she painted every single day. She didn't do anything else. You know, whether it was good times or bad, my mother and grandmother painted every single day. And they had a commitment to their careers.
So do you have paintings of your mother's here?
I do have paintings of my mother's. Let me give you an example. This is something that she was doing in the early part of her career in the early 1970s. This is a painting that she was doing. She did it about 1971, probably, or 1970. It's the scene of a buffalo dance. There are two buffalo dancers and a buffalo maiden dancing in between them. And what you're starting to see here is her use of modern cubism and the abstract background of zigzags and a spray finish in the background that was very abstract, and it wasn't seen in normal day-to-day Indian art. It was extremely contemporary, and it really broke a lot of the rules of what you thought of as traditional Indian art. These paintings here are something that she did much later in her life. You'll see the dates 1980, 1978. She moved from casein watercolors into acrylic painting. And the acrylic paints were something that she switched over to because in Guatemala, where it's real humid, she needed her paint to dry faster. And acrylic paint was just new on the market, and it was known for drying very fast. So she learned the acrylic painting medium, and she refined it. And then they came out with iridescent paints about 1976. And she bought all the iridescent paint she could find in the art store so that she could be the first one to learn how to use it. So anyways, her paintings became very dimensional, you know, and very, very modern looking with the precision of the lines and, you know, the boldness and the just the real graphic, sharp quality. Everything is very strong in these paintings that you're looking at. These two paintings are basically of the same type of design. They're both from the Mogollon era, which is an ancient culture here. They're called Mogollon men. And you'll see this one has a different pattern in its belly. But it's something that you would find on ancient pottery in, you know, like an archaeological dig, you know. And she loved the Mimbres culture. She loved the Mogollon people. She loved the Hohokam people, you know, because they had a real simple way of expressing their culture. And all of these designs you find on their pottery. And this series, I don't know if you remember, but it's a very famous series. It's one of the most identifiable images that exist in Native American art. When you think of the Mona Lisa, you think of Leonardo da Vinci, right? When you see Changing Woman, everybody thinks of Helen Hardin.
Yeah.
That is just unmistakably Helen Hardin. And then there was Medicine Woman and Listening Woman that followed. This became the strongest symbol of women's independence starting in the 80s, because we all identify with these women in some way or another, whether we're struggling to find the healer in ourselves or whether we're trying to change our lives either within ourselves or in our surroundings. Each one of these women, Listening Woman is a very bold and very objective woman. It's really funny because she really appeals to psychotherapists and attorneys. Medicine Woman is usually purchased by doctors, you know. And Changing Woman appeals to most everyone, you know. Medicine Woman, if you look at her face is divided in half. Half of her face is looking inside of herself, and the other half of her face is looking out into the world. And that's why she's called Changing Woman, mm-hmm. and also portrayed by the four seasonal colors for everlasting change.
And this is yours.
This is my work. This is my work. This is, I work very bold. Now, these are all prints, and the reason these are all prints is because this last Indian market, I sold 35 paintings, and we just finished delivering everything. And I haven't had time to get back to painting because I'm writing a book. And so what we have now are for sale, are prints. We are working in digital prints. They're very, very limited numbers. You know, the highest numbers I'll go is 25 or 30 at the most. Some of these only are 10. But what we've done, if you look at, this is a print called Woman's World. And it's three women, and each of these three women have different personalities. The world is inside of all three bodies that are sort of joined. And there's the old woman who I featured as my grandmother, the middle woman who I featured as my mother with some of her own designs from her women, her Changing Woman series as her face. And then mine is very, very modern, more cubist and more dimensional. Mm-hmm. So with these three women inside of the world, you have the different things that the Native women artists do. You know, traditionally, you have the basket weaving. Here.
Oh, yeah.
The basket weaving pattern. You have painting, you know, you have painting here. You have some patterns of different pottery artists that we have. This is more weaving here. And then the painting itself, you know, it symbolizes the painting. Mm-hmm.
I love that.
Thank you. But What I did this for, I painted the original painting and it sold before it was finished. But we made 100 prints of it. And the 100 prints are for sale to raise money for the Poblita Velarde Museum of Indian Women and the Arts.
Okay, why don't we go upstairs and we can talk about that.
You're starting to talk about the museum you're working on.
The Poblita Velarde Museum of Indian Women and the Arts. That's a project that we started this last spring. I just felt that there was a need to keep my grandmother's name alive in a much bigger sense than just a gallery or a book or a room or something like that. You know, I wanted something that was representative of what she did as a person for Native women in the arts. She opened the door. She was the first Native woman, like I said, the first Native woman to paint full-time as a career, period. She is, without a doubt, the most culturally significant woman born in the last 100 years. And the doors that she opened for the women that followed her to be able to pursue their careers, their artistic talents in their careers, whether they were potters, writers, poets, painters, sculptors, those doors were open because there was one woman who did it first.
And was she aware of that? of her significant? Did she think about that?
She didn't think about that. No, no. My grandmother thought about things that like, okay, I need to have 10 paintings done by the end of next month because I've got a show. She thought about things like, I've got to go out in the backyard and finish raking those leaves. Or, you know, she was very humble. She liked going to shows. She liked it when, you know, people recognized what she did. Like, she had so many awards and so many honors on her walls, you know, and it was sort of a running joke, you know, where are you going to put the next one? She was really, really humble about being as significant as she was. Mm-hmm. She was certainly not handed anything on a silver platter ever in her life. Everything she ever achieved, she had to work for.
So let's go back to the museum. What's the idea? It's not going to just be her paintings.
No, it's not going to be just about her. It's not going to be just about our family. It will portray and show for all Native female artists on the continent of North America in every art genre. Like I said, whether it's filmmaking, performance art, music, writing, clay, sculpture, painting, every art genre form will be celebrated. And that is because Native women have been overlooked for so long. And it's really interesting because one of the biggest questions I've heard from some of the most prominent art supporters in our community is, why do we need an Indian women's museum? You know? And that's exactly the reason, is because in the art world right now, in the Native art world right now, the leading artists are female. You have artists like Tammy Garcia, Estella Loretto, Roxanne Swinsel. They are commanding the sculpting market. You have Kay Walking Stick, Jean-Quique Smith, Emmy Whitehorse, past artists like my mother and my grandmother, multi-talented artists like Kay Bennett, Pop Chile, Geronimo Montoya, Tonita Pena, all of these women who were the firsts in whatever they did, they need to be recognized as well. You have writers like Leslie Marmon Silko. I mean, her writing is just absolutely incredible. You know, it's different from anything else that's out there. Women are leading the market, and they are still being overlooked because of the men. And so really, there is a need for this. And it's not just something that's going to be local. It's not going to be a cute little Southwest Museum for Indian Women. No, this is going to be on a very grand scale.
You know, I've known you for a long time and seen projects that you do, and they're always on a grand scale. I mean, your ideas are always, they take my breath away, and then you do them.
Well, you know, I was raised by two women who just did what they did. You know, it's not that you set out to, you know, sit out in the morning and say, I'm going to do something great in the world and everybody's going to be a part of it. It's that you say, there is a need for something to happen. And this is the way we're going to start it out. And it's really funny because there are some other museums that have been started out because one person was willing to write a great, big, huge, giant check for it to happen. And the reality is that that never happened in my grandmother's life. Like I said, she had to work for everything. And here we are. We're having to put this thing together, just breaking our backs to do it, but it's happening. We have a board of directors. We exist as a museum. We do not have a building yet, but that is in the works as well. The building that we're looking at right now is a perfect place. It's a three-story building in downtown Santa Fe. It has a basement, which would be perfect in a curatorial aspect and for archives. It has a beautiful main floor with a restaurant facility attached to it, which would be perfect. And then it has a second floor, which would be great for educational facilities, administrative facilities, lecture places, even some studio space for fellowships, because we want this to be an educational institution as well. It's not just about going into a museum and looking at beautiful artwork, you know, produced by all of these women artists. It's about giving new and upcoming female artists the opportunity to have fellowships and have a place to create their art and a place to do research on other artists, and you know, we want it to be all-encompassing.
What's the time schedule? Do you have that yet?
The sooner the better. We would like to open in 2012. We really would. That would be great. We have the internal structure set up so that once we have a building in place, we will be able to work really fast to put this thing together. It's going to depend on us actually getting the building.
How much do you have to go to be able to, I assume you want to buy the building?
We do want to buy the building. The building we actually would like to purchase needs to be purchased sooner than later. The building we're looking at is about $5 to $6 million, and we've had commitments anywhere from $250,000 to $1 million. We're getting there, but we're not there yet. And then we need the museum capital as well. We would like to start out with working capital to set the museum up. As far as an acquisitions budget, we actually have people coming forward with donations of artwork, which is really sort of neat. You know, we have some people who have said, okay, well, what we're going to do is we're going to divide our collection up. Everything that was created by a woman is going to the Pablita Velarde Museum of Indian Women in the Arts. And I just thought, you know what, that is just so cool. You know, it just, to give it that much thought. And these are good collections. There's all different kinds of artwork, you know, and they're diverse collections in that they appreciate a lot of art forms.
Have you had any opposition?
We've had opposition from local entities in town who see this as a threat to the incoming tourist dollar. And It's not a threat. It's one more reason for people to come to Santa Fe. We have some really incredible people on our board of directors.
Yes. I wanted to talk about that also, because I noticed that Dawn Quick to See Smith is on the board. Mm-hmm. And she's one of the women artists that I think is just great.
Well, Dawn Quick to See Smith, there's some really exciting things. Number one, I asked Dawn Quick to See Smith to join our board of directors because she also ran up against a lot of opposition as a career painter. She was told by one of her instructors that she would never paint as a career, that she should learn how to teach. And she really is a go-getter. She's incredibly articulate. She's known as one of the leading art academics in this country. She really has a lot to say in her artwork. She was sort of a mentor from afar for me. I no longer had my mother around to help me out. You know, my mother actually never knew that I would paint because I started after she died. And Jean would include me in shows, traveling shows in museums and things like that. And we wouldn't talk all the time, but, you know, when we did talk, you know, maybe a few times a year, she was very encouraging. She always told me, you know, just keep going. You know, you're doing great. You know, you're making a lot of progress. Don't let people tell you you can't do this, you know. And it's good for your mental growth. It's good for your health, you know. And she was always very encouraging to me. She is on the board. Roxanne Swinsel from Santa Clara Pueblo. She's a sculptor. She's also very aware of the strength of female artists. She comes from a very strong family of female artists. And she is known all over the country for her portrayal of her primitive style human figures. She has a lot of humor in them. But she's also very she's very outspoken when it comes to what her rights are as a woman. Okay. And then we have Catherine Baker Stetson, who's my hero. she is very instrumental in helping us set up the structure of this organization. And Rick West is her partner. He was the founder of the National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C. Then we have Bruce Adams, who is the owner of the Santa Fe and Magazine. He's on our board of directors.
What about Cindy Ewing?
Yes, Cindy Ewing. Cindy Ewing is not an official member of the board of directors as a director, but she is acting as board of director. But I've known Cindy since the New Mexico Women's Foundation days, back when we were all, you know, trying to get that off the ground. Mm-hmm. And so she is very familiar with the struggles that we have yet to go through. And I just feel like we have a really incredibly diverse selection of people. My grandmother was a Santa Clara woman, but let's remember that the purpose of the museum is to celebrate all Native women from North America, whether it's Alaska, Canada, you know, Mexico, even though Mexico is more Central America, but it's still, you know, all over North America and in all art genre forms, you know, so it doesn't just belong to one tribe. The museum has a website called the PV My Way. Oh, let me explain something. PV My Way, we needed an acronym for the museum. You know, like the MoMA has its own acronym. Well, one of my grandmother's favorite things to say was, well, I'm just going to do it my way then. Well, this is the PV My Way, the Poblita Velarde Museum of Indian Women in the Arts. And so we have a website, which is the PV My Way, PVMIWA.org. You know, one of the great things about the enthusiasm about this museum has been all of the people coming out of the woodwork to be supportive. In the beginning, when we sent an email blast out, my husband does these great email blasts. When we sent the first email blast out about this, the next morning when we showed up for work at the gallery, we had somebody waiting at the front door to give us a check. And we had people over the summer coming in that we didn't even know, giving us checks for anywhere from, you know, $2,500 to $5,000. The enthusiasm for this has been just unreal. And we really appreciate that, because it shows that not only did my grandmother have a lot of supporters, but the whole idea of this museum is very agreeable to both the community and on a national level, too.
What has been the response of women artists, of Indian women artists?
The response has been the women artists that I have spoken to have been very positive. They all say pretty much the same thing. It's like, it's about time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really funny because the first thing they want to do is give me their portfolios, you know. and what the reality is that I'm not even really going to have that much to say about the shows. That's all museum business. That you know, lays in the hands of the directors and the show committees and things like this. You know, I'm just here to get this thing off the ground. And once it becomes its own museum entity, a fully functioning museum, I just want to step back and enjoy the rest of my life and just know that my mother and my grandmother's names have been put to use the way they should be, with honor and with the benefit of other Native women artists, too.
Thank you.
Thank you.